What's up, guys? Welcome to episode 4 of the Data Driven Strength Podcast. Today, it's just me and Josh hopping off the mics again. We're going to go through some questions we got on our Instagrams and also through our YouTube, and just give you guys some answers and kind of go through our thought processes when looking at the exact information presented. So, Josh, let's go ahead and kick you off with the first question. We got this one from our man, Alex Hayes. Why do you think the 8 RPE in kind of quotations has become the ideal difficulty prescription within many coaching circles? Alex, your grammar is not very good, but Josh, hopefully you got the gist there.
Yeah, I think this question is probably asked through the lens in the sense that we have kind of taken a stance against these hard and fast rules of, oh, RP8 is the perfect prescription, or, you know, all your training volume should be between 1 to 4 RIR. You know, we've kind of opened the door to potentially higher RIRs or lower RPEs. And that's kind of been some stuff we talk about. However, I don't think that this kind of heuristic of 8 RPE is bad, right? I think the repetitions in reserve based RPE scale kind of came to light because we understand that there are downsides of training to failure. So the next step is, of course, to stop a few reps shy of failure. And that's generally speaking, a good idea. So I think I'd probably leave it at that is we know that training to failure has some negative consequences, potentially without an actual benefit. And 2 reps shy of failure is a good heuristic, right? It's you're going to ensure you're somewhat close to failure, which is probably a good idea, something we'll probably talk about with some of these later questions we have lined up. But you're also not getting those negative consequences of going all the way to failure. So admittedly, it is a really good middle ground. However, we're trying to bring to light some of the potential utility of lower RPEs, as well as ensuring RPE accuracy and all that good stuff. So Zach, let me know what you think about that.
Yeah, I'm mostly on the same page there. I think one story I always think is pretty funny when Mike is ever on a podcast and he's kind of talking about the origins of the RPE scale, and he's always talking about how leaving a rep or two in a tank was like very, very submaximal in comparison to like what he was kind of used to and what kind of was historically the norm at that time. So I just always think that's pretty funny. So like you said, I think it's just kind of a natural middle ground to say that we know we need to train hard, but there is consequences to training all the way to failure. So it's just kind of that, you know, middle of the bell curve that we kind of fall into naturally. And like you said, I think what an 8 RPE means exactly, I think is kind of dependent on your training background and all these kind of things that you mentioned that influence RIR accuracy. I think often what it is considered an 8 RPE is probably far more submaximal than, you know, is maybe intended on paper. It's not to say that's bad. Obviously, we've talked about the utility of lower RP sets a lot, but I also think that people don't give enough credence to you take a set all the way to failure on like a leg press or something like that. It's literally just 2 reps shy of that experience. And I think that is still a very, very hard set that I don't think people give you know, enough credit a lot of the time. But yeah, I think it's just kind of a natural middle of the bell curve that's kind of just fallen in place over time.
Yeah. And just to hop in one more time, this is not my term, but Dr. Zordos often says at the end of the day, the RPE scale or rating RPEs of sets is to determine whether you're training to failure, close to failure, or far from failure. Now, of course, we want our athletes to record whether they thought it was a 6.5 or a 7. Like, we think that can be important. Or you know, the difference between an RP6 and an RP8, which could both be categorized as close to failure. But again, an 8 RPE kind of gets you in that somewhat close to failure range. I'll go ahead and throw out the next question for you, Zach. So this was not a question, it was a statement, I guess, or a demand. Go through the history of why strength is specific.
Oh, that's a Josh, the grammar police is out here. Anybody that knows Josh personally knows he's a very, very good writer. So he likes to make sure his commas and his periods are correctly placed. But yeah, this is a good question. I think obviously Chris Beardsley book, Strength is specific is very popular, and for good reason. I think it really conceptualizes a lot of the ways that I think strength training can be kind of taken a step back and viewed, like the variables, how we can organize these to most efficiently get towards the goals or the adaptations that we're looking for. But I think as far as going through these things individually, I think, you know, specificity obviously needs to be in context to a goal. And so if we're talking about strength here, I think in most cases, we're going to be talking about a 1 RM for powerlifting, but that's not necessarily always the case. So if we talk about load, for example, what specificity means for a 1 RM is going to be different than maybe, let's say, like at the NFL combine when they do a 225 bench press. So that's not necessarily training for maximal strength, but it's still testing your force production in a certain capacity, in which maybe the way that you view these variables when we talk about load, contraction velocity, joint angles, all these kind of things, all of those need to be viewed in the lens of the test in which you're assessing the strength. So I think that's the first thing to kind of realize. And the way we understand that is because in the research, for the most part, if you look at these variables in isolation, whatever seems to more closely align with the specificity of the way that you're testing strength seems to improve that adaptation to a greater degree. So this is kind of how the principle of specificity has been termed the king of all training principles, which makes a lot of sense. And I think anybody that has been kind of around the strength training world kind of knows that. But as far as the history lesson, I don't know if I can go into too much more specifics than that, but the overall concept is that whatever the test is that you're training for, you need to look at the training variables, intensity, volume, frequency, all that kind of stuff, and contraction velocity and joint angles as well, to align with the tests that you're trying to improve. That's not to say that doing things outside of that is also beneficial, because this could be a very, very long conversation. You could have a couple hour long podcast about this point itself. But in general, training more specifically to the goal that you're trying to prove is going to be your best bet forward. So I think maybe where this question is coming from is we seem to have disagreed with this point. I would probably say that we haven't. Because so if we isolate on this contraction velocity point in specific, I don't necessarily think that our position is that contraction velocity doesn't matter. I think contraction velocity very well does matter, and we should train specifically for a 1 RM strength event in that department. Where we may kind of just break that down a little bit further is that we think that contraction velocity should come because the weight is so heavy on your back, and that is what slows the contraction velocity down to mimic a 1 RM, rather than having a accumulated amount of fatigue throughout a set, which is another way that contraction velocity can slow down, in which if you're looking at like just the number, maybe if you're measuring this on like a linear position transducer, like the repetition is at X meters per second, that may be closer to your 1 RM, but in true terms of specificity, it might not be in the exact department we're looking for if we're looking to maximize the specificity of that characteristic in terms of the 1 RM. So Josh, that was kind of long-winded there. Go ahead, clean up whatever I missed.
Yeah, so I think all that's a good start to this question. You know, in terms of how we actually apply the concept of specificity for strength or specificity for any fitness adaptation, you know, that doesn't necessarily have to be strength, right? It can be other athletic endeavors. We know that, you know, if we just follow the principle of specificity to its end, the most specific way to train is to practice the test. And that's can certainly be helpful, right? We have some indication in the research that daily 1 RM training can be a productive way to increase strength. However, we also have to understand when to stray from specificity. So this is where you think of what kind of goes into the equation to ultimately lead to a greater 1 RM. And this is the how you kind of get into periodization. So if you're only following a specificity framework, we would just do everything at 100% of 1 RM. However, we know that accumulating training volume, in general, greater training volumes are going to lead to greater strength gains. And we can't realistically do that with 100% of 1RM. We probably can't even do that with 90% of 1RM. So thus, you have to stray from specificity in order to accumulate that training volume. And that makes sense when we start to think about the influence of muscle growth and potentiating future strength gains. So again, strength is indeed specific, but understanding when you have to stray from it can inform how you periodize or how you set up a training week as well as how you periodize things and set up a training cycle, which will lead us right into the next question.
One point real quick, Josh, I just want to hit on that too. Like, don't misconstrue, and I'm not saying you're saying this, Josh, just to clarify. Don't view specificity in a bimodal fashion. Either you're training specifically or you're not. It's more of a spectrum, and all these variables can be, you know, more or less specific, but it's not necessarily that you are training specific or you're not training specific. Just because you're not doing the competition lifts at a 1RM doesn't mean that you're training completely with a lack of specificity. Just viewing that more as a spectrum, I think, is a helpful way to conceptualize that rather than viewing it as a bimodal thing. So go ahead, Josh, with the next one.
Yep. So that'll lead us into the next question, which is just how do you structure an 8 to 12 week training cycle?
Yeah. So this is obviously a pretty involved question. I think it probably is the most helpful to kind of start from the wide lens and then maybe delve a little bit deeper into the specifics as we kind of go along here. So from a bird's eye view perspective, so we have like 12 weeks of training. I generally would break this down into, kind of three different phases as far as the way that I would conceptualize this in most cases. So you're going to have some type of a hypertrophy phase. You're going to have some type of a low fatigue strength phase, and then you're going to have some type of peaking that you're going to execute. And when I say that, I don't think the peaking is going to be that much different than the strength block. The way I delineate those in my head is it simply has some logistical considerations, especially if you're training for a powerlifting meet, let's say. Generally, in that case, we want to have, some exposure to something really close to your max so we can have a very, very accurate gauge for attempt selection. Also, probably want to hit some openers so you can get some psychological familiarity with those loads. And then also, there's probably going to be some sort of a formal taper, and that can vary a lot depending on the individual. But that is just like the basic bird's eye view component of how I would set up a training cycle and the length of those phases, what is, within those phases and how much they differ from one another can be extremely, extremely individual. But just as like a home base starting point, that's probably where I'm going to start. And then Josh, you can kind of give your, anything else you have to add there, and then we can probably go to the next level.
Yeah. So again, if you have a 12 week training cycle, more or less half of it's going to be hypertrophy emphasis, half is going to be a strength emphasis. And the key word there is emphasis, right? It's not the only fitness characteristic we care about. The way that we conceptualize it is during a hypertrophy emphasis phase, you are trying to, you're potentially making some sacrifices in training specificity, or how frequently you're touching top end loads or, exercise selection in order to maximize the efficiency, in which you can accrue muscle mass. And then at some point in the training cycle, you kind of flip the switch and we still keep training, volume rather high, but the focus becomes more so on those top set performances. And we kind of adjust things to maximize performance on those top sets. But again, the training setup and the overall training volume, at least the way that we do it, is not night and day. Really, when I set up a training cycle, the weekly setup is quite similar. The exercise selection is quite similar. There might be some transition, but it's not like we're going from, this like 20 sets of hamstring training, in which you're doing a ton of like non-specific work and you're going and running 10Ks. And then by the end of the training cycle, we're doing, just a bunch of doubles with 90%. It's kind of a, again, it's kind of a gradual change. So something that might be a communication issue on our ends is when we say we're in a hypertrophy focus phase, that's not to say we don't care about top end strength. We're still observing estimated 1RM. We're still keeping tabs on it, and we're willing to make changes as we see fit. But the focus is to maximize the efficiency at which we can accumulate muscle mass. And then again, the emphasis just kind of switches. And that kind of leads into the next question, which is how much do you change the number of sets from a hypertrophy phase to a low fatigue strength phase? So to give a very basic example of this, let's say somebody was doing 3 sets of 10 at RP 7 to 8 on a belt squat. What we would do is we would keep, in a lot of cases, keep the belt squat volume, and we would observe the loads they're using in the hypertrophy phase. And then in the strength phase, oftentimes we will actually prescribe the loads. And what we'll do is we'll kind of flip-flop, or we'll break up the total training volume they were doing into more sets. So let's say they were doing 3 sets of 10 at 100 pounds, and those sets were all at RP 8. Maybe we would do 6 sets of 5 with a similar load. And again, we're keeping training volume quite similar, but we're reducing the average RPE. So our mechanism for reducing fatigue and kind of setting things up to maximize performance on those top sets is reducing the average RPE. That's our mechanism for fatigue reduction. We can still keep training volume pretty high, and we're quite confident that the hypertrophy stimulus is still pretty dang good. And the focus just kind of shifts. So that's kind of how they complement each other. And again, we're still doing belt squats in the strength phase. It's not like it becomes this hyper-specific sets of 1 to 3, and we don't care about growing muscle mass at all. One of our primary reasons for keeping training volume rather constant throughout a training cycle is, yes, we might want to maximize your performance for a meet in 12 weeks, but I also care about how much muscle mass you're accruing right now, because I care about how strong you're going to be in 3 years. And probably your best investment for that is doing adequate training volumes in order to accumulate muscle mass. Again, it might not be perfectly optimal in terms of the rate of hypertrophy, but it's still pretty dang good. And that's a good long-term investment. So hopefully that clarifies how we kind of just simply shift the emphasis, as opposed to completely flipping the script and go from training like a bodybuilder to training like a hyper-specific powerlifter, which is very much not the case.
Yeah, that's literally the only thing I have to add there. You did a great job outlining that. Is training for powerlifting is going to be training for powerlifting essentially always. That's always the thing I like to clarify. Like you said, Josh, like I think our position in the periodization often gets a little bit misconstrued, in the sense that a lot of people will say, well, quote unquote, hypertrophy didn't work for me. And I think there's some validity to those, you know, to those statements, depending on the context in which they're kind of presented. But often I think that's because you get too far away from what powerlifting training is, you know, should be 90% of the time, which is going to be some exposure to heavy loads, a decent amount of training volume, some practice with the competition movements you're trying to actually improve. And that's what our training cycles consist of. It's just, like you said, a small shift in bias to try to optimize the rate at which we can occur either muscle growth or express our strength. So that was a really good outline. I don't have too much to add there. I'll go ahead and read the next one. Go ahead, Josh.
If you're cool with it, let's hang out on this question for maybe a few more minutes, just because I have a couple.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have a couple more thoughts. So earlier in this podcast, Zach mentioned that specificity is a spectrum, which I think is an excellent way to conceptualize these things. And this is particularly relevant in how we can still train specifically for powerlifting during a hypertrophy focused phase. Again, it's not like we're not prescribing comp squats during a hypertrophy phase. The way that I would conceptualize it, or the way that, you know, we tend to program, is how can we get sufficient practice on the competition lift or a close variation without significant side effects that lead to less productive hypertrophy focused training. For some individuals, they might be able to do 4 singles at RP 8 on the bench press throughout the week and be totally fine to accumulate their training volume on probably a more hypertrophy focused movement after that. For other individuals, their peak intensity exposure might be a triple at RP6. And generally speaking, those individuals are also going to have, less top set training stress in the strength phase as well. But the point being is, where can we fall along that specificity spectrum in order to minimize the negative consequences on hypertrophy focused training? So using myself as an example, I don't tolerate a ton of competition or close variation squat training volume, especially with heavy loads. So maybe during a hypertrophy focus phase, I have one top set during the week, maybe a couple back off sets. And then I go and I really the focus of the training block is on something like a belt squat or a variation that's more efficient for quadriceps hypertrophy. But then in a strength phase, maybe I add a second top set exposure during the week in order to get that practice. Again, we're being smart in terms of gradually building up to that, but maybe that's something we bring in during the strength focus phase, and that's at the expense of effort and focus and quality of the volume work after it. So hopefully that clarifies a bit of how you can still maintain skill and confidence on the main lifts and potentially even increase it. It's actually quite common that people will go on runs during hypertrophy phases. By the way, it's not like strength is going to be blunted, but hopefully that helps frame the way that we kind of think about that. And then the next thing I wanted to touch on is that, and mostly just to clarify, as Zach mentioned, at the end of the cycle, we'll often run 2 weeks, give or take, of like a peaking phase in which, you're doing the logistical things of okay, what's a temp selection going to be? What are openers going to be? That is very much optional. Especially if it's just a training cycle in the off season, or you're not a competitor or whatever, you can just take one light training day, hit a single at 9.5 and move on to the next training cycle, or not even touch anything heavy, right? I just wanted to clarify that, that peaking phase at the end is optional. You can just flow right into the next training cycle. So, hopefully that clarifies some things. Zach, feel free to add anything. If not, we can roll into the next one.
Yeah, no, I think that was helpful. Just to kind of that to me, it's always useful to have like the kind of the principles in which we're kind of abiding by in the hypertrophy and the strength phases. To me, just to kind of like give bullet points for what I heard you say, and you tell me if I'm mischaracterizing you at all. In a hypertrophy phase, we're shooting for kind of the minimal effective dose of competition movement exposure. That will continue to build or maintain our confidence on those movements, along with our skill and proficiency on those movements as far as technique goes. And then we're looking to maximize the quality and our focus and our intent on the volume work that is going to probably produce the majority of the muscle growth. Contrary to the strength phase, kind of flip that switch. Now we're looking to maximize our focus, intent, and everything on the top set exposures and our technique on the competition movements. And that might come to some degree of sacrifice on the, I don't want to say the quality necessarily, but the intent and the focus kind of to some degree, the amount of effort that we can put towards on those back off sets. It's not to say those aren't very important, because they are. And I think we've kind of talked about that at length, but if you are, and we talk about this all the time, if you're working up to a top set that comes with a considerable amount of arousal, which we usually try to limit, especially in hypertrophy phases, but towards the end of the strength phase, that's something we do want to get a little bit of a practice with. So as you kind of increase that arousal naturally with heavier loads, that's going to come with the expense of a little bit of a kind of come down on those volume sets where your focus intent might be off a little bit. But at that time point, it's probably an okay trade-off, because we're looking to maximize short-term strength in which the top sets are probably going to provide the majority of that stimulus. So I think that's just an easy kind of bullet point way to think about that. But I very much agree about the peaking phase. That is totally, in my mind, only applicable in the case of somebody who wants to compete generally. If you're looking to just test and you're just kind of doing it in your garage or whatever the case might be, a light taper session and kind of just testing those singles at 9.5, like you mentioned, Josh, is a totally fine way to go. And so I just want to reiterate that we don't want to take options off the table. If you think you're ready to go after taking a light session and you want to test something and then just get right back into training, that's totally a fine way to go about it. So go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and to clarify, this discussion of training cycles is kind of a theoretical home base, and it's all subject to individualization. Every training variable is subject to individualization, whether that's the length of the training cycle itself, how many blocks are in the training cycle. We kind of frame this as a hypertrophy-focused block and a strength-focused block. Some individuals might do best with two hypertrophy-focused block followed by one strength-focused block. I also sometimes do a block in between a hypertrophy and a strength phase, and I sometimes call it a transition block, in which we kind of start sprinkling in some of these low fatigue strategies. Just the general relative length of a hypertrophy versus a strength focus phase, based on what kind of their performance bottleneck is. If I just think the best way for this athlete to go is to just get a ton of muscle mass on, maybe the focus of the training cycle becomes, or maybe we just spend a lot more time doing hypertrophy focus phase. Maybe the whole training cycle becomes hypertrophy emphasis, just because we know this is our investment, right? We have a meet in 12 months, and there's really no need to do a strength focus phase. We can see these slow climbs in top end strength while just hammering away at this hypertrophy work, and really making that our investment. So that's the last thing I have to say. You ready for the next question, Zach? I can throw it out there. Cool. Okay, so the next question is, why not keep all back down work at around RPE 5 in order to minimize velocity loss, minimize fatigue, and maximize tolerable volume?
Yeah, so this is a really good question. I think, if you've gotten a chance to read our article, I think a lot of people have kind of taken this opinion that, like, well, you guys are saying that minimal velocity loss maximizes strength stimulus and can still provide a pretty solid stimulus for muscle growth if you equate the volume to higher RPE training. Why would we not just do that all the time? So I think there's maybe one or two mechanistic reasons that I would maybe question that line of thinking, but then probably much more importantly, logistically, I think there's some limitations to that approach. So I think thinking about this just from a mechanistic standpoint of, like, why would we not do this all the time? I think that while it's fair to say, based on the research that we do have, that, you know, lower RPE sets can still be very stimulative for muscle growth, I think there, you know, you're making a few assumptions there that's going to be effective all the time and maybe not just a short-term strategy, but also that by limiting velocity loss and thus intraset fatigue, we also are limiting the effect of metabolic stress. And that, while I believe mechanical tension is far and away the primary stimulus for muscle growth, you know, you could make a conceivable opinion that you're losing out on something that may have to do with, accumulating a little bit of that peripheral fatigue. So I think that's two mechanistic cases you can make against doing that all the time. However, I think, again, those are probably the minimal arguments, but the majority of the arguments, I think, are the logistical ones, in the sense that if you're saying we should train at RPE 5 all the time, one of the immediate questions I would have is, how do you know you're training at RPE 5? A huge limitation with RPE is that the lower we get on the RPE scale, especially with higher repetitions, is that the RPE becomes more inaccurate. And we know that there seems to be kind of this threshold load that seems to be pretty important if we're going to be able to maximize muscle growth far from failure. So kind of bringing that all together, if you are training at low RPEs, we need to know that we're at that threshold load, and that's going to be very hard to do due to the natural inaccuracy of RPE. So I would say having a period of time in which you are training closer to failure kind of allows you to check your work and then also have a reference point for the next cycle you choose to train far from failure, to know that you're within that kind of relevant range of an effective threshold load, which is probably going to be somewhere around a 10 RM or heavier. So let me look at it one more time. I think that's pretty much all I got there, Josh. Oh, the last thing would be just psychologically doing that style of training after having done that myself for a while. It's draining in its own way. On paper, it's definitely less fatiguing, it's not to say there's no fatigue, though. It's definitely still hard training. That's going to take a toll on you over time. And doing that day in, day out is just a different kind of challenging. And the way I always like to describe it is like having 5-minute rest periods between a couple sets of volume at a relatively high RPE takes kind of some type of short-term mental effort. But if you're doing a low fatigue protocol where you're taking that very same amount of volume, but you're splitting it up over a lot more sets with shorter rest periods, you kind of have to stay mentally engaged during that entire 20-minute block or so. And it's just a different style of fatiguing, in my opinion. It just kind of feels different. So it's just something to keep in mind there. Psychologically, it'd be pretty difficult, in my opinion, to be able to do that all the time. And just the variation for variation's sake, I think, is a very useful tool. But Josh, I probably missed some stuff there, so go ahead.
No, I think that was really good. And I love this question, because when we kind of formulated, you know, I hesitate to use the word model because it might not be the best word, but when we kind of fell on this framework for programming and periodization, we kind of had to ask ourselves a few times, why not just keep the intraset fatigue and thus the average RPE, especially of the back off work, quite low year round? What's the downside? And Zach covered a few of those reasons. So just to start, and this is my, this is admittedly a lot of my personal conjecture, based on my understanding of the research. And again, just my conjecture. Zach might not totally agree with this. And I know there's plenty of people that might strongly disagree with it. But again, my conjecture is that I think a training program could be set up, in which all of the back down work is around RP5. And you can maximize muscle growth. I think there's a formula in which that's the case. Again, I think that's the case, but I'm not certain. You know, although we kind of talk about some of the research that has led us to these conclusions, there's a ton of uncertainty. We often talk about how do we know individuals are actually training to failure in these studies? How are you defining failure? How are these different groups progressing? We're really just trying to do our best to put the pieces together. But there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of what the actual answers are. So part of the reason we will have these hypertrophy focused phases where the average RPE is higher is to cover our bases of uncertainty. We know training closer to failure generally leads to more muscle damage and greater metabolic stress, especially with higher rep sets. We don't think those are the mechanisms for growth independent of mechanical tension, but what if there are? Why, what's the downside of covering our bases there? So that's kind of one of the reasons. We don't want to make our entire training paradigm based off of something that we're not entirely sure of. And then when we pair that, you know, covering our bases of uncertainty with two things, with the practical reasons Zach outlined, yes, I can, you know, say this is an RP5, but how do I actually know this is an RP5? How do I know it's not 10 reps in reserve? We know that generally speaking, when you're farther from failure, your RPE ratings are generally inaccurate, which isn't a huge deal. But in this case, if we're doing this year round, having these periods of times where we're kind of checking our work during a hypertrophy phase and we're touching RP8s, maybe even RP9s, we can get a temperature check. So that's the first reason, is that practical reason. And the second one is probably more important, is the psychological reasons. So me personally, and I know Zach has told me about this as well, and I've heard it reported from athletes, is just kind of adjusting the focus can really, really help, right? When we flip the switch to a strength focus phase, all right, it's go time. You know, that's not to say you're not training super hard in the hypertrophy phase, but it's like, oh, okay. You know, I was able to, you know, last training block, I was able to be a bit more chill on my top sets and just kind of approach them as practice. And then I really did my high bar squats and my belt squats, and I trained those really hard. Oh, now I get to flip the switch and I get to and focus on these top sets and kind of get this bit of a controlled aggression with them. You know, that's kind of exciting. And I find that by the end of a strength phase, you're ready to focus on the volume work. And at the end of a hypertrophy phase, you're ready to focus on the top set work. So it kind of, this psychological resensitization cycle kind of works itself out over time. And me personally, even though I have that conjecture that I think you could train with a low average RPE on back down sets year round and maximize growth, I don't really want to do that. So, and also plenty of people have trained at high RPEs and gotten very strong. So that's something we have to add, right? We don't want to just completely stray from that because we have some research indicating otherwise. So yeah, hopefully that outlines things pretty well. Zach, if you have anything
to add. I just want to chime in a few things there. I think two things. The first, I think you raise a really good point as far as the uncertainty in the research and the overall landscape of this area. I think, you know, it's not uncommon to see protocols that involve high repetition sets, supposedly to failure, with less than 2 minute rests on multi-joint exercises. Now, anyone that's been training long enough, now, and again, I'm not putting any fault on the researchers here. I'm not by any means, but anyone that's tried to, you know, do anything even remotely close to that in practice knows that's damn near an impossible protocol to complete effectively. So when a lot of the research is based on protocols that look like this, I think it is important to kind of question, what is our anchor that we're kind of establishing failure at? And so we have all of these studies that we kind of have conceptualized where the effective zones of proximity to failure are. And there's still a ton of limitations with that. But I think more importantly is that anchor point, depending where that's at, like Josh said, defining what failure really is in a study, I think that shifts the entire paradigm that we have right now to kind of tell us where these ranges of proximity to failure are for a given adaptation, whether that be strength or muscle growth. And by that, I mean, let's say that anchor point of what we define as failure is lower than what we really would call failure in practice. Maybe that means we can train much further from failure and get all of the adaptations that we were looking for. Or maybe that means that there's this range really close to failure that has been relatively unexplored that actually could give us much, much greater adaptations. And maybe training to failure really does maximize muscle growth and strength. I think you can make it a conceivable case for that just from a theoretical perspective on the limitations of the research. That's all to say that we can't have super firm conclusions about this because of the methodological concerns that come with researching this. I think that's just something you need to keep in the back of your head.
And then finally, also be the opposite.
Yeah, right. Right. I think I said both of them. Maybe I didn't.
My bad. If that's okay.
No, you're good. I think that's important to consider is that the landscape of this stuff is shifting. And I think having a really firm definition of where that failure anchor is would be very, very helpful. And then the final thing I would say, just to kind of hedge our bets, as Josh mentioned it a little bit, is to me, the overwhelming anecdote of people who've gotten really, really big over time is that training relatively close to failure seems to be a staple in their programs. So I'm not saying that is a validation of the way in which they train, but in my mind, if there is uncertainty, generally I would probably lean in that direction. So that's just kind of my two cents in that. While I think we can make a pretty strong case that you don't need to train super close to failure to maximize muscle growth so long as volume is equated, it would be hard for me to say that we can do that all the time when we have this, to me, overwhelming anecdote that training close to failure is how you should train for muscle growth. So I think just keeping that in the back of our heads probably makes a case for this kind of periodized approach that we generally like to take. So that's pretty much I got on that question. Josh, are you ready to head on the next one? Cool. So the last one here, how does deadlift programming differ from the squat and the bench?
So this is an interesting question. The first difference between the deadlift and the squat and bench that comes to mind is that the competition deadlift does not include a controlled eccentric. We'll probably get into some of the considerations of that, as well as some of, we'll briefly talk about some of the research on, you know, the comparing neuromuscular fatigue post-training after squat after squats versus deadlifts. However, the first thing I would point out is that there's likely to be larger differences between individuals as opposed to between lifts on average. So what I mean by that is, you know, yes, maybe on average we have a lower deadlift frequency, but between individuals, I think individual considerations prevail over these averages in practice. So that's the first thing I would point out. But then to get into the discussion of the eccentrics is that, you know, again, when you're doing a competition deadlift, you're not performing a controlled eccentric. So something that we like to implement is some sort of variation in which you are performing a controlled eccentric. That essentially leads to double the work per repetition, right? So presumably double, it probably wouldn't actually work out like this, but a greater hypertrophy stimulus per repetition, and perhaps just a little bit more room an extra training variable to draw from to throw into the hypertrophy fire. So that's kind of how I would frame it. I'll stop there. And if you have anything about the eccentric conversation or inter-individual differences.
Yeah. This is a tough one just because it's hard to talk about this without like a tangible example in front of you. I think, you know, people often talk about the common anecdote that deadlifts are more fatiguing. I think recently we've had some research that would suggest otherwise. But I also think it's common in the evidence-based community to run with that research maybe a little bit more than I'm comfortable with. So generally the way that in which we're measuring fatigue from these studies is either from some type of serum measure of muscle damage, or sometimes they'll have some type of like isometric contraction to measure actual performance. I think that's good. And I think that in most cases can tell us that deadlifts aren't more fatiguing than the squat in most cases. But at the same time, I do always, like I said, in kind of the last question, I'd like to reserve parts of my answers to this when there is an overwhelming anecdote in one direction. So if people, for whatever reason, have found deadlifts to be more fatiguing, for kind of over time, maybe there's something is to that. I'm not going to hold a kind of a really firm opinion either way. In most cases, I don't treat them differently, but for whatever reason, if somebody finds that a deadlift beats them up more, maybe I'm more likely to kind of dip the frequency and the volume down a little bit. And I think that's fairly common. Now you could get into an even more meta discussion on this is like, is that psychological conditioning rather than anything physiological? And I think there's also maybe some arguments for that. But in most cases, I think I'm with you, Josh. I think, you know, I just really try to emphasize some type of eccentric on the deadlift just because in most cases, I don't think that's going to provide an infinitely greater hypertrophy stimulus. But in this specific circumstance, for a lot of powerlifters, they've never done a correct hip hinge in their life. They've never had an eccentric loading of the RDL, like of the hamstrings and the glutes in the way that you would on a nice, solid, controlled, stiff leg deadlift. And I think there's a lot of like newbie hypertrophy gains to be had there, which can in event probably propel their deadlift pretty quickly, which I've seen that quite a few times. So that's just something I always like to include. And then Josh, kind of one thing you also wrote down here is less psychologically demanding than the squat. I think that probably reigns true. And a lot of people, just from the simple fact that like, if you fail a squat, you actually have to drop the bar, on the deadlift, you can kind of just set it back down on the ground. So I think that's something to consider too, that might impact depending on the way an individual kind of looks at that challenge on their program. That might individualize the way you would approach programming for either of the two lifts. But I guess kind of to wrap up my ramble there, in most cases I don't treat them differently too much. I would just emphasize different things based on the normative case of like the new client that comes across my desk, of kind of the way that they have been training in the past. Almost always, I think there is some super low-hanging fruit for the deadlift, especially from a hypertrophy front, that we can take advantage of, that I might stress a little bit more initially from the deadlift program perspective than maybe I would from the squat. But overall, principles are the same, still kind of going after the same things. I just think the approach or the way you frame it might be slightly different, but that was definitely rambly. So go ahead, clean that up if I missed anything.
No. I think that was actually, you covered everything I wanted to cover. I probably wasn't very clear in what I was saying about differences between individuals compared to average differences. So for me personally, I feel more comfortable with a higher frequency on deadlift than I do a higher frequency on squat. However, on average, most people find that they can do a higher frequency on squat than on deadlift. But again, I'm the reverse. So I think that prevails over, you know, what the average finding is among a group of individuals. So I just wanted to clarify that. And again, for me and for a lot of people, I think, like Zach said, there's something less psychologically daunting from a deadlift compared to a squat. And for that reason, I'm again, there's the anecdotes about deadlift being more fatiguing. There's the research saying otherwise. For me, again, just my personal experience, deadlift is much less psychologically, quote unquote, fatiguing than compared to squat, just because, again, if you miss, what's the worst that can happen, right? You just drop it. So maybe the reason that we see these anecdotes that deadlift is more fatiguing, maybe people are actually training closer to their desired RPEs on the deadlift because they feel more comfortable doing so, or they feel safer doing so. I'm just throwing that out there. I have no clue whether that's the case, but I think Zach did a good job of explaining how, on average, I'm not convinced there's a huge difference in terms of what your starting point is. You just kind of got to gather some information as to, you know, what beats you up more, what feels over-recovered, what feels under-recovered, which do you need more practice on, like how much skill do we have to gain on each of the lifts, all that good stuff will contribute to the individualization process. So we didn't really give any distinct answers there, but hopefully listening to our thought process can help you better conceptualize how to approach this for yourself or for other athletes.
Cool. So the last bonus question we have, Josh, we have a Muscle Lab alumni, Christian Macarilla. So shout out to Christian. He asked specifically, Josh, do you like boxers or briefs?
Briefs? And I'm not sure, and I hope that's not contentious.
I would have to agree. This question is specifically addressed to you. I would have to agree. And if maybe we can get a poll going in the comments on the YouTube video here, just in case, to see if anybody's insane. We can check that out. But
is there a way to block people on YouTube?
Yeah, I mean, maybe we can figure out some coding just to see if anybody puts boxers, they can just immediately get blocked and never be able to see our videos again, just because that's objectively the wrong answer. But yeah.
It just sounds like a miserable existence.
Yeah, you know, they're going to rip and just, yeah, it's just the whole deal. So, but yeah, thanks for the answer. Shout out to Christian. Christian's a good dude. He's doing his PhD out at South Alabama University right now. Just always like it's to shout out that. Oh man, sorry, Christian. That was I tried, dude. But yeah, Christian's a good dude, so I always want to shout out past lab members. So that's gonna wrap up this episode of the Data Driven Strength Podcast, guys. Thanks for tuning in once again, and slowly building our listeners to hopefully double digits. You know, once we crack 10, I feel like we're really gonna hit some momentum in the podcast game here. Maybe give Joe Rogan a run for his money. So we appreciate all of you guys taking the time to listen and communicate with us as far as comments on YouTube and everything. So I think the cheesy thing to do here is if you give us a 5-star review on the Apple Podcast app, I'm pretty sure that helps. I know people say that really does help is kind of the common quote there. I don't know if it actually does, but if you have time to do that, that would be much appreciated. And also just let us know if you ever have any additional questions. The link to that form is in both of our bios on Instagram. But yeah, thanks for tuning in again, and we will see you guys soon.